I never thought really I would get to that point. I remember going to Ambassador College. It was 1981 when Big Sandy reopened, and I still remember the following year, the first year, Mr. Leon Walker was the deputy chancellor, and another Ron Kelly was the dean of students. The next year, there was a change, and who was overseeing the operations, and so at that time, Mr. McCullough came in. And I remember Mr. Salyer's story as he was talking about all the transfers. You could ask any of the older ministers, and my father-in-law would have told you they will today. My mother-in-law and wife, not my daughter, even though you look young enough. Points, points. will tell you that I believe all the years that my wife was living with the family, they had never lived anywhere longer than 3 years. So transfer. It can be really difficult to go through these constant transfers. But Mr. Salyer told me the same thing, that they had just gone up to San Francisco, looked for a place, found a place. They were starting to unpack when they got a call from Pasadena that said they wanted him to be down in Big Sandy to be the dean of students there. So just when they were unpacking, they had to pack back up and go back to Big Sandy. So a lot of interesting tales that they can tell you about. And I was requested this year because I've known them so long, and it's like we've been on the same path in all the different churches that we've been through, just about the same thing. And I still remember them vividly from back in 1982 when I first met them. And he's obviously, as you know, retiring. I know he'll still continue to serve, but it's been wonderful to really know the Salyer family. All the children are in the church. It's just been really neat to be able to walk with them. And so they asked me to do a little write-up, a little one. I ended up doing a lot of write-up. There's not much that you can't say about Mr. Salyer and all the things that that he's gone through and all the things that have transpired with him. But again, it's just been a blessing to be able to know him, and I hope that God blesses them with some years in their retirement that they can really enjoy it, because their life has been in the church, and it's brought a lot of physical ailments upon them when you go through the stresses that we've all gone through, and especially in positions that he's held as director of the ministry back in Pasadena. They were right there and had to go through a lot of that. So it's not been an easy road for them. But I remember I was trying to get, what was the point I was trying to make? I remember looking at my Bible, because he got up for a forum, as we'd have Tuesday and Thursday. You would have just before lunch an hour, somebody would speak. You'd have outsiders sometimes. I remember John Gardner came in. He was a world traveler and would tell us about his travels and stories. Other times, normally on Tuesdays, you would get one of the faculty that would talk and bring a topic. And Mr. Salyer at that time showed us his Bible, and it was kind of dilapidated at that time. And I had this brand new one. I mean, the date on this is still, like, it's written in here. It says, "To Eric, with much love from Mom and Dad, August 1981. I thought that was interesting. So mine was brand new. When he was talking about this, I was just in the process of finding the right kind of ink pen. You wanted the Indian ink or whatever it was called. I found later you could pretty much use different types, although the Indian ink wouldn't bleed through as much. So I still have, for instance, in Hosea here, I've got my margins are just filled with notes. You know, that's kind of a neat thing, and I'm in a transfer process now of taking a new Bible. It's harder to find wide margins, and especially King James Version wide margins. I wanted to bring this today because I've got descriptors in my sermon today that only can be referred to in the King James. The new King James, you know, goes back to English. It's easier to read. I still prefer using this one because there are some details in there sometimes that's not revealed in the new King James Version. But, you know, mine's kind of falling apart as well. I must have been reading James a lot. They call it the Book of Straw, and this is the one that seems to be the one that kind of fell the most apart on me. And so I got a lot of notes on that, too, and they're kind of quickly fading, so I better get to it and redo my notes. Now, I've got a lot here, as maybe you've had your Bibles as well. Some things have changed over the years. Hopefully, I'll remember to let you know a couple of things that have changed as we've grown in knowledge. I think we will still grow a lot in knowledge. I think there are things that are going to be happening in the future that will just blow. We will say, I never thought it would happen this way. you know, to even describe what happened in the past. You know, I only know what happened in the past during the time of Israel because I watched the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. You know, that's the best that you can do. But I bet there's detail within that that we're totally missing. Moses will say, that never happened. I never did it that way. But how did they do all this? How did they communicate with a million people? You know, in the Ten Commandments, you saw Moses was talking. They were in that valley, and they said, all you people here that are with me, gather over here. Bam, God put the earthquake in there, and all the people fell in it. Well, all the people that were on the screen, there were over a million people. You couldn't capture that on the Ten Commandments. They did the best that they could do. But again, we're missing some things that you wonder. I wonder what that was really like, what really took place. Now, we go back to a concept that I like to talk about today, that we've, in my memory at least, it seemed to be about every year during the Feast of Tabernacles that you would get a sermon on government. There was going to be a government sermon. And after researching this, I actually might continue the tradition. You know, it's so interesting, though, on the concept of government, how we looked at it, because I don't believe, I've not seen any pyramids lately. Some people out there may still have them. But I remember the church being described as a pyramid. Do you all remember the pyramid structure that we had? There was, in fact, in the scriptures that I had where it talked about the chief cornerstone. Christ is the chief corner. That was described, and I'm not putting anybody down here, by the way. This is the way that simply that we looked at it. But my descriptor in there, in cornerstone, I had in the side, I had capstone. The capstone. So we used a structure and we put that in there and then kind of described that, even though the description of the chief corner was not accurate. It just wasn't true. And if you remember, of course, none of us really, even if you didn't maybe agree with it at the time, I think everybody just wanted to be agreeable. And so you kind of go, okay, I pretty much have the basic concept. You know, you've got God the Father, you've got Jesus Christ, even though how does that one fit the pyramid? And which one is the true capstone there? Or are you just putting Jesus Christ there? And then who are the other two? Because it seemed to be that you had God the Father and then Jesus Christ and then Herbert Armstrong and then evangelists and then pastors, other things. I couldn't see how that looked like a very unusual pyramid. So you really can't get the descriptor on that. So we've come a long way with that. For a time there was a group I was involved with that understood that was not accurate. So we actually flipped it. So you had an upside down pyramid, and I was a little bit frustrated because I'm going, there's no pyramid in here that describes how God works. Even though throughout the Bible there is government, we place so much emphasis on government, even though it's only mentioned, at least by word government, I've got three times you find it in Isaiah. One time you see it in 2 Peter where it says, chiefly among those that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government. They despise government. The others in Isaiah, now a really good descriptor here you find, and most of us obviously know this one. Maybe you don't know exactly where it is, but I'll read from Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. Now, two of the places here, government is rendered here, are in verse 6 and verse 7. And here's what it says. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it, to establish it with judgment and with justice. I just heard that word called justice. Interesting. The characteristic and the concept of God. There will be true justice. We're not seeing much of it now, are we? There's not much of it. There's lots of accusation. There's lots of despising, especially despising of government. If you don't like the guy in charge now, just despise him. Say everything bad that you can dig up or find out about him. But yet we find other people that are getting away with everything. There's no justice. Even certain senators that I like, the senators are pointing it out, but I'm going, they're not doing anything. Nobody's doing anything. There's no prosecutions. Even if they're found out to be guilty, nobody's being prosecuted. If something is so wrong, why isn't somebody getting in trouble? Why is the little guy getting in trouble, but those who have had certain realms or certain high responsibilities, everybody seems to be getting away with it, don't they? But they're really not. No, we understand that. Nobody's getting away with it. You know, God's going to bring justice. They're going to have to answer for a lot of wrong things and bad things that they've done. But they're not being judged now. We are. And so we've got to follow these simple steps. Glad it was brought to 3 points. That kind of makes it easy. But you realize it's not as easy as it seems when you've got to walk that type of life. But you realize here in Isaiah 9, you're talking about a broad concept of a time frame. Unto us a child is born. That happened a long time ago. That was prophesied all the way back in the Old Testament to happen. It did happen. No, absolutely, the fulfilling of prophecy was there, but then it goes on to say what's going to happen in the future. Oh, won't it be a breath of fresh air when Jesus Christ returns with his saints and establishes his kingdom? No more of the politics. And we're going to have practiced this, probably never to perfection as we would like to do, but at least we're in the process of moving in that direction. And now because of that, and God calling you a saint, he goes, now you're going to rule with me, and now I'm going to give you the fullness of my power and of my understanding. And we'll be able to rule with him in justice and judgment to teach everybody. And all the lessons that we're going to hear at the Feast of Tabernacles that only give that taste and picture. But you know, government is only rendered 3 times. But it's interesting when you look at the Hebrew of it because it can get really confusing. One of the descriptions here of government comes from the Hebrew word memshalah. Memshalah, it can mean dominion, it can mean government, it can mean power, it can mean to rule. And that word, it says, total King James verse occurrences are 16 times. So why do they render it government here, or maybe dominion somewhere else? And I didn't take the time to do all that, thinking about going into that study and saying why in the Hebrew is something rendered this way, but over here they render it a different way. And sometimes you realize when you look at the contexts, that's why they'll choose a word that best fits the context. And that's where we learn to be better Bible students as well. Another word comes from Misra, M-I-S-R-A-H, and it can mean an empire, and it can also mean government. So you'll find other places within the scripture that the scriptures are there that kind of fit the overall government. So, yeah, is government important to God? Yeah, it is. It's very important. There's been government from the very beginning. If you're talking about a rulership, if you're talking about authority, you can see that from the very beginning, how he established the family, didn't he? You know, the man was in there placed as the head of the family. You can see how God operated when you say he created the helpmeet. He never meant it to be an overruler. Somebody that pounds what God called to be the weaker vessel. They were to work as a team, but the man was given the authority to be put in charge of the family structure. And then you see that same thing within the church as well. But many things get construed because mankind wants to take that authority, and as we see, when we even go back to Ezekiel 28, you know, Satan wanted to say, wait a second, who are you? I'm the one in charge. So something happens weird with the mind. And it happens within the family too, doesn't it? There have been abuses, many abuses. Some of you maybe have endured some of those. It may be the opposite way. Maybe some of the men have been beaten by their wives. Believe it or not, that's happened. It certainly has happened. But there never should be abuses in that way to say, wait a second, who put you in charge? I'm the one in charge. So we always have had these questions on who's in charge. And so the church, if you see how this has worked out over the years, and I know that you have a good response to this question because sometimes we got it mixed up between a corporate structure and a spiritual structure of who's in charge. Somebody would say, well, who's the head of the church? My simple answer now would be Jesus Christ. If you're talking about the corporation, I'll tell you who the president is. But you know, before, Mr. Armstrong used to carry the title Pastor General as well. That could get a little bit vague. That could get confusing sometimes. And people would say, well, Mr. Armstrong is the head of the church. Don't you realize within the pyramid structure, it's God the Father, Jesus Christ, Herbert Armstrong, then the evangelist. I'm going, that's not what the Bible says. It's not necessarily when you're looking in the church, even though there's authority and the weight that's carried there, it's not as simple as looking at it as we do now. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 12 or Ephesians 4, when it lists these functions or offices, they're there put for the service of the church, not the apostles saying, hey, I'm over you, I'm telling you what to do, and you do. Yes, there was authority, but it's not as simple as looking at a structure like that going, now the apostles told the evangelists what to do, and the evangelists told the pastors what to do. You know, Mr. Walker is considered an evangelist. There's not much said about evangelists now, I think because of what we've gone through. People looked at those like we did in the military as ranking structures when there were functions. But I think pretty much think that Mr. Walker is way too busy, you know, doing what he's doing than to be around and telling a pastor what to do. There may be correction that might be needed from time to time, but when you look at the age of this person, it's not necessarily because of the title. It's because of the seniority that he's had, the respect that he's gained within the church. And it wouldn't just be to say, I'm telling you to do this because I'm the guy in charge. Believe it or not, that was done before. And maybe some of you have been recipients of that or have seen that happen. That's not the way God says to function. Jesus Christ obviously pointed that out in the book of John that says, yeah, I'm your Lord and Master, but I'm not the one that's the overlord. I'm he that serves. That was the whole point. And it's taken a long time for the church to really understand this concept. So I'd like to go all the way back to the Old Testament to see how God functioned at one point in time here to show what is his form of government. Does it have a structure? And is it always the same throughout the age? Numbers chapter 27, let's go over here in verse 15. See, we see a pattern here where God called a person. It's so interesting as how he called him. It seems in many cases when God called somebody in the Old Testament that the ones he called did not really want to do it. It just, they might have recognized the responsibility and say, no, I really don't want to do that. I don't like all the stuff that comes with it. And even Moses was, you know, himself, he said to God, I'm not a very good speaker. You know, I can't talk very well. And so God said, okay, I'm going to use Aaron to be your spokesperson, but I still want you to be over my people as you lead them, even though, again, he wasn't going to be the ultimate leader because Jesus Christ, the God of the Old Testament, was the one that called the shots, if you want to look at it that way. But in verse 15, this is a time now where the baton, as we remember, we saw that in the past as well. You would see the feast, for those of you that saw feasts, the messages, we saw the batons being passed. And of course, in every other group, we started to take a look at who the baton was passed to. Who Herbert Armstrong passed the baton to? Was it this guy who leads this church, or was this guy that lead the, how many batons do you have? I ran a baton race, we only had one. No, I didn't grab the other one, go, well, wait, where's the other ones? There's only one baton. And is that really the analogy that we use? It's one that came up with, but everybody took that and kind of, not, no pun intended, but they ran with it. They ran with it, didn't they? And a lot of people, in some cases, we could say drop the baton as well, because where are they, right? Where are they today? So it says, Moses spoke to the Lord saying, let the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, which may go out before them, which may go in before them, which may lead them out, and which may bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be as not sheep which had no shepherd. Now, don't forget here, Moses was often in contact with God of the Old Testament at that time with no one ever had, and this is what we're going to say. So, you know, you would say, well, where'd he come up with this? Well, but they had talked about it. What was going to happen when God said, you're not going to be allowed to go into the promised land? Well, Moses obviously knew his days were numbered. What was he going to do? Keep wandering in the wilderness? No, God was going to take him. That was his time. And Moses knew that. So it says, the Lord said to Moses, take ye Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit, and lay your hand upon him. Now, when you look at this word rendered in Hebrew, it's very interesting because when you look at the lexicons, it's different. It says hand. Take your hand. Now, I don't know if you've got that rendered in your Bibles. Is it in the New King James? So it is just hand singular, or is it hands? It is singular then. I know some translations may do it differently. You look at the same word and it's translated hands in other places, and that kind of gets confusing. But when you look at the base word and when you look at the context and when you look at the way that it's rendered in the lexicons, it does say hand. So there's something different here that's taking place. And something was going to change. This is the whole point. Whether you agree with the lexicons or the translations or whatever, you're going to see something different. The way that God worked with Israel now. It says, set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and give him a charge in their sight. So here we see Moses, knowing that the end of his days were upon him, asking God to set a man over the congregation. But who selected Joshua? It was God. Not Moses, but God. Now in verse 18, it says why does it say lay your hand upon him? You see, because what would happen when you see in the context of what was taking place, Joshua was nowhere near, would not have the authority that Moses had. Let's go on to continue to see what happens. Because see, Joshua would only be receiving some of Moses' responsibility and authority. Some. Here was called a transfer of power. In a very interesting way. See, earlier in the book of Numbers, the question of Moses' authority came up in light of a situation where some felt he was disqualified from his responsibility. But we read that God looked at it differently. Let's go to Numbers chapter 12. God saw it much differently. Let me ask you this as well. Did God ever put somebody in charge that was perfect? Obviously, that's an easy answer. You know, it's always easy to see the faults in someone, especially if they're in a leadership position, because you're presented in the light of everyone. Everybody sees what you do or what you don't do or what you've fallen short in. So it's very easy to view that and to see that. Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, because he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Has he not spoken also through us? And the Lord heard it. Very interesting. Verse 2 is a very dangerous, dangerous statement, isn't it? And I think you all look at that and know that. We could also say, hey, this guy makes his share of mistakes. Can I do this too? By the way, don't we see this principle nowadays? As I've seen within, and I'm not going to point at any, I'm looking at the overall thing, at what was done. You know, you ministers didn't do this. I've heard the accusations. You didn't do this. You fell on this. And certainly it was easy to see some of the missteps or mistakes that were made. But guess what? No minister is going to be in charge of us anymore. We're going to do it. We're going to set up our own congregation. And we're going to have groups of people that make the judgments. And I looked at that light in light of what else happened or would happen within the family, because this is a structure you can see again that's being undermined by Satan the devil. Because I've asked out here for those that are fathers. Have any fathers here not made mistakes before? How many fathers have made mistakes? Sometimes pretty serious ones. But all of a sudden people are saying, guess what? We see your flaws. We see all the problems that you're having. Hey, who needs this? We're doing away with fathers. No more fathers. Hasn't this nation kind of gone that way, in a sense? You know, they called it a long time ago. They called it the women's lib movement. We're not going to wait on these guys, because you would always get those commercials that were played all the time where the guy was just a goofball. He couldn't figure anything out. And the woman would come along and go, hey, I've got the answer to that one. And so you'd even have commercials like that where the guy was portrayed as some kind of doofus. So therefore, hey, guess what's going to happen? The women can be in charge as well. We can run the families. In fact, we're going to take another woman and we're going to work together. Wow, you see some of the parallels that truly are there. Verse 3, it puts in here, now Moses, the man Moses, was very meek among all the men who were above on the face of this earth. That's what gets you to kind of wonder who actually wrote this or maybe added to it. you know, Moses put most of the books together, but I can't see Moses, if he's that meek, talking about himself that way. Let me put in parentheses here now. The man Moses was very meek. Just wanted to add that in there, folks, so you know that. I think this was an addition by someone else. And the Lord spoke suddenly to Moses and to Aaron, to Miriam. He goes, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of the congregation. And the three came out. The Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth. And he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known to him in a vision, and I'll speak to him in a dream. And you can see testimonies of what he did to some of those in dreams. Abraham or Jacob or others, or even on into the New Testament. You had John that was given revelations. You had Peter seeing the dream, if you remember in Acts chapter 9, about the clean and the unclean food, that he had to decipher the meaning of that as well. But this is consistent with God. But he said in verse 7, my servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all my house. With him, I'll speak mouth to mouth, even apparently, and not in dark speeches, and the similitude of the Lord will he behold. Wherefore then, in other words, if being that's the truth, why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Wow, well, talk about an eye-opening moment. And very interesting, if you remember, the situation where Moses actually wanted to actually, I know I've heard your voice, but I'd like to see you. And they were so close that God honored that. He goes, but you can't behold my glory. So he had to put them him in the cleft of the rock and kind of shield him, because you couldn't look upon the glory of God and live. And even doing that, it says, remember it says Moses saw the hind parts. That's where I took from that and go, if he's got hind parts, he's got front parts and top parts and bottom parts. We're created in the image of God. We may not understand that spiritual aspect of what it's like to have a spiritual body. And that's going to be the revelation of what we're going to see in the future. But we realize, again, as we're going to the Feast of Tabernacles, how one of the best parts is going out and having fellowship and food and drink. Anything you can want, even the hamburgers if you want. But you know, we can sit down, and I try to vision what it's going to be like in the future as we go through the rebuilt waste places in the cities. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking about this. How are they going to be set up? What's it going to be like? There's going to be the crops, the wheat crops, the harvests that will take place. And of those grains, people are going to make breads and cookies and cupcakes, but no GMOs. And I'm walking down the street, just checking this new city out, and all of a sudden I smell this smell. It smells great. You know, did you ever go by a steak place and you get that kind of aroma and go, man, does that make me hungry? It smells so good. Or you go by a bakery or smell this fresh bread, and you can go in as a spirit being and go, hey, let's sit down and talk. Have maybe a cup of coffee and maybe a biscuit or something like that that's just been made. Wow, how, you know, again, we can only give little tastes. It might be totally different. I kind of think, though, that God made us to be able to fellowship and eat as he did with Abraham and the three spirit beings, including Christ himself, that were with them. Abraham said, kill the fatted calf. So they ate. Spirit beings ate. So it's interesting to look at this, that Moses was able to see the glory of God. He goes down to Israel. They had to kind of go like this because Moses was a glow stick. I mean, virtually took on that glory, and his face shone that he had to even put a covering upon it. Remember those cases and that evidence that you can see. Moses was very different than anybody you ever saw before, or anybody, frankly, that you ever will in the Bible or nowadays. Unless somebody can profess that they saw God. But if you did, your face would be a beacon. It'd certainly be shining, and he'd have to shield you, otherwise it would kill you. So he was pointing this out to kind of put them in their spot here. But until the arrival of Christ, there was never anybody like Moses again. You never saw that. You can go through the stories of the judges, then of the kings, then, you know, what took place there. And we see again, once again, God never relinquished his authority over any of that. He never said, now you're on your own. You know, even after they said, well, we want a king. You know, God said, I knew that was going to happen. But guess what? You don't get to choose him. I'm going to choose him. So how does he rule today? He never relinquished his authority over the rulership, over the dominion of all of mankind. You know, he allows certain things at times. He may choose certain people at times. We don't always know that. Some people ask, did he really select this person, or did he just allow them to be there? As I said, God never relinquishes authority. He knows what's going on. You can see that from the story of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4. So only some of what was given to Moses. Numbers chapter 27, let's see what happens here. Numbers 27, 21, you can see again the transfer of power and how different it was here. Numbers 27, verse 21. Here it says, and he, speaking of Joshua, Joshua will stand before Eleazar the priest, who will ask counsel for him. Who will ask counsel for Joshua? After the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. If you remember the story about the Urim and the Thummim, God indicated certain things by the way that the stones would light up or whatever. There were certain decisions that God was going to communicate, only it was not going to be directly with Joshua as it was with Moses. Moses didn't have that. So now it was going to go through Eleazar. Eleazar would tell Joshua. So it says, at his word will they go out, and at his word, speaking of Eleazar's, because Eleazar was going to communicate this with Joshua, they will come in, both he, Joshua, and all the children of Israel with him, even all the congregation. So God said in this indication here that Joshua would be the next leader of Israel, yet he would not be able to make decisions of and by himself. It would go through Eleazar. Now in Hebrews chapter 3, we'll find a comparison. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 1. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. Wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle, here is, he's rendered apostle, right? And high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him, speaking of the Father, that appointed him. So that's where you get, again, where Christ said it's all in that one package. You can see how it rules. Christ himself said, my Father is greater than I. How did that start? We will stay tuned. You'll see how that transpired. But right now we're given that God the Father is the one that is in charge, that Christ sits at his right hand. He's given the responsibilities, but he goes, I don't do anything without the Father letting me know what it is. So as also Moses was faithful in all his house, for this man, Jesus Christ, it's speaking of, was counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who has built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he that built all things is God. And Moses verily was faithful in all his house as a, see what it says here again? Moses was faithful as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken afterward. So when you look at the whole package, see, when you look at government, when you see authority, you gotta read all 2,000 plus pages, don't you? You really do. Because you find indications and pieces of that that you've got to put together to see how God works, to get the big picture. Therefore, the little things won't be confusing to you. You'll see how God works. There's consistency, and it's not about who's in charge. It's about being a servant, what you're going to do with the authority or the responsibility that God gives to us. In verse 5, the word servant, in verse 5, you see here, as a servant, it's not referring to the Greek word diakonos, as one would find usually referring to the ministry. This word is from the Greek word therapon. Think about that. Remember, we consider root words therapon. Where would you relate that to an English word nowadays? Consider your massage what? Therapist. People have therapists. What's a therapist supposed to do? It's supposed to make you feel better. So that's where you get the word therapy. Therapo is supposed to fix something that's not feeling so well. It comes from the Greek word therapon. It's a root for many modern words, but it's having to do with someone who helps to heal, to increase the ability of one to function, or one who supports. So you can see that Moses, in a sense, was Israel's therapist, wasn't he? His therapy for Israel, to help them, to guide them, to lead them. And sometimes the one mistake he made, you know, and you kind of go, not bad. You know, you try 40 years of making one mistake. You know, I've got a family of three. I've made tons of them. You know, all of a sudden, I got this straight. I'm supposed to be the overseer, not overlord, overseer of my family. And see how well you do with three children that are all different. And how of them just lighten your fuse. I go, I'm certainly no Moses, that's for sure. Because my fuse is blown too many times. I've seen, take a deep breath. You can try to count to 10. And even with God's Spirit, it's not easy, is it? And here, again, some of the things we don't see when you're walking with these stiff-necked Israelites, and God's, and Moses and God are in communication. I think that kind of helps Moses to kind of see the big picture too. When you can communicate with God like that, I would think, oh, if I could see God, if you could talk with me directly, oh, I'd be the perfect person. Really? You think so? We're still human beings, aren't we? You can think that. But again, you look at Moses and how he was used by God and that one mistake. And God held a high accountability to him. But still, again, Moses is going to wake to the real thing, isn't he? To the real promised land. But here's the point. The Old Testament church, the physical nation of Israel, never again had another Moses. The New Testament church didn't have a Moses. They liked it to be, this is where we're going to go and see, they wanted it to be, did we have a Moses? I think we did. His initials, HWA. People wanted to put him up there in this prominent position. And he was in a leadership position, there's no doubt about that. And some would even ask, I'll talk about it. I can't prove it, but some would say, well, was he an apostle? And that's very important to some people. If you don't see him as an apostle, then you don't believe. No, that's baloney. No, I recognize the position, the responsibility that God gave to a man and what he did. And sometimes it was easier to see some of the mistakes that were made as well. Should that take him out of authority and out of the responsibility? Don't believe so. But again, it's the way that we looked at it. There was no Moses, even though some people wanted to put Paul. No, it's not Paul. It's Apollos. So the same thing was happening. Who was in charge? Title of the sermon today. Who's in charge? The New Testament church had and still has Jesus Christ. Again, when you read verse 1 of Hebrews 3, it says, the apostle and high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus. That's the high priest of our profession. Some in the church today feel that we should have an absolute human head, much as Israel wanted a king. Some, even more powerful than, or as powerful as Moses, having the same authority. And so they give all their credence to a man. If I just follow in his coattails, I'll be in the kingdom. I'll just follow the man. And that's natural human tendency to do that. Some today still make this claim. 1 Samuel chapter 8. So we can see this story, fascinating story. I brought up from time to time, if you look at this fascinating story. You know, how many today understand and know our Declaration of Independence or even our Constitution? There have been so many constitutional violations. So many. If you look back at the way the Federal Reserve System was created, just speak that one right there. And other things, other violations, go, why has not anybody gotten in trouble? Because there's a lot of powerful people that have got a lot of money. And they say money sometimes rules the world. It won't in the future, and it shouldn't now, but this is what happens. It's not changed. The mentality and attitude is still the same. It goes all the way back to the very beginning. But verse 4 of 1 Samuel 8, all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now give us a king to judge us like all the other nations." And you know, it does say that the sons were evil. They had a point there. You could have verified, go, yeah. It could have been the bonanza syndrome. You know, it's the torches. So you're going to hang the guy that's in prison who really hasn't done anything wrong. But everybody gathers, yeah, you know, let's get rid of this guy. Yeah, Samuel, you're getting old. And, you know, and God rebuked them, even though they may have had a point. So what was the problem? See, verse 5 is the problem. What should they have done? They should have gone to God and say, "God, be merciful to us. These things happen. Something's not right here, but we realize we don't have the responsibility and authority. You are the head. You are the one that's in charge. Please help us with this situation. Maybe if you saw some meekness and humility, things would have been different." But God knew that they wouldn't. So he gave them a king. But there were rules. They had rules. And they said, "The king is to do this. He's to do this. You're, in fact, to write a copy of the book of the law." Why? So he would know what God was saying. There's nothing more oppression than having to write it down and to look at, oh, God says this, because sometimes we'll go back and read and review the, oh, you know, I must have missed that. I didn't see that one. Oh, that is in there. As I've even mentioned before, I did a review even of the Sabbath, and I mentioned this. Is there any time ever within the scripture that it says, now it talks about the Sabbath, holy convocation. Is there ever a time that it's not? You'd have to agree. There's never a time that it's not a holy convocation. The Sabbath is a holy convocation. Unless there are a couple points you can pick up on for the Passover. If the way is too far, if the journey is too far, or if you're sick. That makes sense. But some add their own little tidbits in there, their own Talmuds. "Well, I just don't feel, I'll stay home and watch a video." Is there ever a time when it says it's not a holy convocation? Okay, so the same thing happens. You know, the king would drift as well, and many of the kings did. There were very seldom was there a good king, like a Josiah or a Hezekiah. And even then, some of them had their issues and problems as well. But you didn't see very many good kings. So it didn't work so well. And you see all the things that said the king is going to do that. He's going to tax you. He's going to do this. And so in our Declaration of Independence, that had to do with a king of England. He's taxing us too much. You go through Samuel and you go through our declaration, you're going to go, wow. You know, up 1,000 years plus later, everything that God said, they're writing in our declaration. They're making a statement on it. Very interesting. You see, you go all the way back to the old and it ties in with the new and beyond. Now, God did not say that having a king was evil, did he? It wasn't evil. He was just saying that having an absolute ruler was going to carry some risks and yield overbearing circumstances, as he definitely explained in detail. And now you can see over history and understand if you have a man of good integrity, a good person, things are going to go pretty well. If he has absolute authority, go pretty good. Even England, if I remember, had some decent kings or queens, but none of them were perfect. If you look at their history as well. But once that Pharaoh passes from the scene, once that, I call it the Pharaoh, because remember when Joseph was in Egypt and the Pharaoh, and he brought all of his family, but all of a sudden a new Pharaoh came into town. And I brought it up to nowadays, to the modern day time. We had a nice church for a while there in Knoxville. And I remember the pastor, because he used to live in my neck of the woods, really, really close. You know, his high school here and mine there. And I even told him, because, you know, he was a few years older. He goes, I used to date a girl from your high school. I said, I wonder if it was my sister. And we started laughing. We had a really good relationship. And you know what? A new Pharaoh came in. He didn't know us. He didn't have the same thing. In fact, that other pastor said, I looked at your statement of beliefs. And there's obviously things that we can disagree with, but I saw that you believed in Jesus Christ, and that's good enough for me. I said, thank you. Lasted for a couple of years, and the new Pharaoh came in. And so we didn't last very long when the new Pharaoh came in. So you'll see that, again, in rulership and church history and in modern-day history as well. But you can take a look and question the controversy of Peter's authority and ministry. Let's go to Mark chapter 3 and verse 13. Very interesting what it says here. And again, we're going into some detail here. I'm going to read from my old King James here, or just the King James version. Mark chapter 3 and verse 13. It says, he, speaking of Jesus, went up to a mountain and he called to him whom he would, and they came to him. And he ordained 12 that they should be with him, and that he would send them forth to preach. The topic of ordination comes up now. You know, it seems now a lot of people take that on for themselves, and they ordain somebody, and that's not what God has in mind. So it's really interesting. When the ordination process takes place, this is another interesting thing over the years that we've come to. Ordinations maybe had some favors attached to them. Maybe there was, people have said, a buddy system, to where I knew him and it was a buddy, so he ordained this person. And see, he had some people by their fruits that you could kind of see. Now, it didn't really pass judgment, but you question it when somebody would act or react in a certain way or carry this overbearing personality and tell people what to do or check their cabinets to see if the women had makeup at the time. All kinds of things were happening like this. Does it take away ordination? No, it doesn't, but hopefully it's done a lot better. So what happens when we ordain? Do I take it upon myself to just go and ordain somebody? Or do I ask some of the other people and maybe kind of get a church view on how they look at a certain person? Is the person respected? In many cases, the person is already doing what they're going to be ordained to do. You can kind of see it happening. That's the way it should be done. No, by getting multitude of counsel, isn't that what God says? So therefore, you're not taking this overbearing thing, oh, that's the guy I'm going to choose because he knows what I want, and whatever I tell him to do, that's what he's going to do. That gets dangerous. Very dangerous. That's not the way that God intended. But he did ordain them, and they did ordain others as well. As you can see, Paul with Timothy, by the laying on of hands, it speaks of that in that way. Verse 15, so he's going to send them forth to preach. Verse 15, along that with that's going to be power. Power to heal sicknesses, to cast out demons. And Simon, he's surnamed Peter. So Simon was surnamed Peter by who? Added to the name. Very interesting. You know, he did that many times, didn't he, when you look at the testimonies? Because if you remember one specific one from the Old Testament, do you remember a name change there? Well, there was Abram, who he changed to Abraham, right? And then there was also a big one, was Jacob. That was a big name change to go from supplanter to prevailer with Israel. Well, now you've got this taking place, and it was for a specific reason here. He's surnamed Peter by Jesus. Now, obviously, we all have given names, which is your first name. And your family name is your surname. Now, you look at history, and many times you'd see descriptions. You know, you think about something like a carpenter. I'd like to see, really, I'd never delved into this, many people have, but when I think of a carpenter, I'm thinking of Karen Carpenter. You know, but that wasn't the case when you were named Carpenter a long time ago. Same with, there were barbers. There were masons. There were smiths. Got a few of those around here today. Smiths, but it carried a connotation of what you did. A hunter, or even a steward, one who takes care of the grounds, or the business of a household. In ancient times, you can see that there were no surnames. Instead of a surname, they were often called Mark, the son of John. Do you remember, even in the past, you probably saw a movie called Ben-Hur, right? Ben-Hur. Do you ever think about that? So what was the character's name? Charlton Heston, once again. He gets involved in all these kind of things. But you saw, what was his name? Judah Ben-Hur, or Judah, the son of Hur. So that's where you get the surnames. For instance, Swanson. They did some history on that. That was the son of Swain. Some of you may see that. Well, I thought that was the people that made TV dinners. It's the son of Swain. Then you get in the family history with my father, my grandfather on my mom's side, who was a full-blooded Swede. And his name, in here, at least in the United States, was Anderson, but I did a trace down to his grandfather. And his grandfather, if I remember this right now, now I can't remember. It was Anders. Anders. So why didn't I think of that? That's the whole point on this. So with the Swedish people, you see Isaacson, Peterson, Williamson, you know, all these sons. And with the women, it's daughter. D-O-T-T-E-R. You got Lars daughter. You know, different names like that. So I go, how could a son of Anders? Now I got how grandpa got the name. His name was Rudolf Valdemar. That's about as sweet as you can get. So son of Anders. Very interesting, again, how different cultures name them. But the point here is the surname. From Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, the surname is a last name, a name or an epitaph added to a person's given name, such as Richard. Richard from England. How many remember his surname? Anybody that's good in history remember a King Richard? What was the surname given to him? Richard the Lionhearted. Oh, good. How many people now know that in history? He was called the Lionhearted because a ruler in England, he led his troops into battle. He killed a lot of people and he loved war. He became a legend of bravery, fierceness in battle, the heart of a lion. He was bloodthirsty. Now let's go back to Mark chapter 3. And verse 17, Mark 3, verse 17. Now, James, the son of Zebedee. Now we get here where you can see once again throughout the Bible, you can see little indications like you can in nature as well, that God's got a sense of humor. And here we're going to find one as well. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, and he surnamed them Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder. Isn't that something? When you look at the characteristics and descriptions of James and John, and of course the mother, the sons of thunder. So you wonder, what was the dad like? Because the mom came and said, granted that this one would be on your right side, the other that's on the left, and Christ was so patient with that. He goes, the sons of thunder, here they come again. Right? Perfect, right? Perfect timing. God's got a sense of humor, doesn't he? So there are those that read something, and this is from the Greek word, by the way, bronte, B-R-O-N-T-E, which means to roar, to roar. So there are those who read something, though, into the surname Peter and conclude the fact that Peter received a surname all of a sudden set him apart in some special way that bequeathed the title of, as we used to know it, a chief apostle. We had chief apostles. There's apostles and there's chief apostles. So that's what our mentality was. So we've thankfully come a long way with the understanding. Because when you look at who the chief apostle is, who would that be today? In fact, we even question sometimes as though these names are given in a way to show what they did. Apostle meaning to send out, one sent. So if you were to give that to Mr. Armstrong, it seemed, at least to me, that he was sent out. He went through all the world and talked with world leaders. Now, it's not salvational, and I can't prove that, but it seems that if there was one, he was, by the way, ordained an apostle. He was one, I believe, I think he was the 40th of 70 that were ordained. And I remember, by the way, you wonder where he was at the time, or if all 70 were really apostles, or if God honored that one and worked with Mr. Armstrong throughout the ages. Oh, I believe when you're thinking about ordinations and things like that, as I thought about when I was in Utah and ordained to be a pastor, that made sense because it's a function to go out and to serve the churches as a shepherd. And I was going to need God's help and strength. And so there were four that were there. And I was so grateful that were four, because I kind of had a thought run through my mind praying to God. I'm going, I hope one of these takes, because you're going to need the strength. And the help from God to be able to serve in a certain capacity. But these are not, they're positions of service. Not titles in that way of authority. So if surnames in the scripture have that kind of power, then just what is the description or significant or of being named Boanerges, the sons of thunder? Where's the significance of a title that's there? The answer, there is none. There is no significance. It's simply a description. Some will say, well, it's just a description, but Peter was the title of the ancient priest. And if you look back into the mystery religions in that sense of where a lot of this teaching even to this day came from, you can see there was the pater, the Peter or the pater. Where one may find this in history, can we ever find a biblical description of a leader in Israel being given that title? You see high priest, but you never see the pater or a Peter. You just not find it. You also not find it in any Jewish or Hebrew history. So if the Jews in Israel never called their priest Peters, very interesting, once again, in church history, where did it come from? See, I say this because there are some that will put significance on Peter to the point that encompasses one's salvation. You look to a person. Most of the world does today. They look to one. And by the way, this is going to change. You know, from where it's at now, as bad as it is now, to one coming on the scene, who are going to give all their authority. What? To this beast power. To this one person that comes on the scene that dictates everything. It's incomprehensible for us right now. But it's going to happen. In our lifetime, sometimes I go, wow, you know, in a sense, I hope not. But if it means to speed up the return of Jesus Christ, then let's go for it. You know, so all these things being put into play that we're watching, this happening over in Europe and the Brexit, is that going to have any significance? Watch. These things that are playing out with our elections today, is that going to have significance? Watch it play out. Things are changing. It's not the same and it won't be the same. So if anyone uses, though, Simon's surname as a proof of a doctrine on which salvation could be based, then you owe it, at least they do, to go to the scriptures and find out where this comes from. To take someone else's word for it, obviously, we understand is foolish. We need to prove all things. Now, this book has been questioned, but there is some significant history I'd like to quote from Hyslop's The Two Babylons. Here it says, before the Christian era and downwards, there was a Peter at Rome. I remember years ago I saw some writings from Dr. Hay on the significance of whether that took place, whether it didn't take place. Obviously, Paul went to Rome. But there's a significance on Peter being a Roman. There's really none of that except for this name changed here. He occupied the highest place, though, in the pagan priesthood. The priest who explained the mysteries to the initiated was sometimes called by a Greek term. It was called the Hierapont. But in primitive Chaldee, the language of Babylon at the time, and the priesthood of Rome came with the priesthood intact. From Babylon, the language of the mysteries, the title was pronounced without the points. It was Peter, or the one who interprets. So I remember, for those that didn't have the opportunity to be a part of other pagan associations as I was, everybody expected the pastor to know everything. You didn't read the Bible. No, that's the case today. You know, when I came into the true church of God and people had their Bibles open and they were writing in them, you're writing in your Bible? That's sacred. You know, but if people actually brought their Bibles. When I went to my church, I didn't bring a Bible. I don't even think they had them, you know, where the hymnals were. You didn't have a Bible. You found more Bibles in hotels than you did in churches. If that's the case today, I don't know if things have changed more in the evangelicals. I think more of them bring their Bibles. But again, you know, you can see what's taken place. And it goes back many, many years. It continues here, quote, in countries far removed from one another and far distant from Rome, these keys were known by initiated pagans not merely as the keys of Peter, but as the keys of a Peter identified in Rome. You'll find, if you search ancient history, that priests of many pagan nations carried the title Peter, but the original Peter, the priest, was in Babylon, and the office then moved to Rome. As Babylon lost its power, who gained the power? Rome. Well, when the religion came to there, as we have always seen kind of Jerusalem being the headquarters church. That's where the apostles came to make the decisions. That's where you gather together. And again, no one had the supreme authority, although we had questions about that for years. Who was it? Was it Peter? Was it Paul? Was it the one he spoke? He is the pastor. Who was the one that was, what was so important to have the one in charge? And yet you can see the way that they worked. They worked together. They collaborated and they made a decision out of that. And they had a hard time after that decision because it was a tough one. So if God intended, though, that there would be a chief apostle with absolute authority in every age of the New Testament church, and the basis for that is Mark 3, then this would be the only doctrine in the church that has as a basis what the pagan religions followed 1,000 years before Jesus Christ. So Jesus wrote the same history, or John, I'm sorry, John wrote the same history. This will be interesting. Here, John wrote the same history of the life and teaching of Jesus many years later, and he wrote it when we're going to look at to set the record straight on this topic. Because if you remember, it was brought up, who's in charge? Some say I'm Paul. Some say I'm, it hit right away. There's always been this question of who's in charge. And John did not cover the life of Christ the same way that you'll find written in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He focused on certain events. An attempt to put the church back on track, because by the time you get to the 90s, it was messed up. Is that such a surprise, by the way? When you look at history, when did you come into the church? I came in what I felt was the true church in the early 70s. Some of you were earlier than that. Some have grown up in the church. But mine started in the 70s. And wow, this was the true church. They'd studied their Bibles. It made sense. You listened to what was said. That made sense. You'd write it down. You'd study. You'd look for yourselves. Don't prove it because I said it. Prove it for yourselves. That seemed to kind of change over the years. You had to accept certain things because someone just said it. And some would say, well, you've got a bad attitude. Well, it wasn't a bad attitude. I just had a question that didn't seem correct in the scripture. And I talked to Mr. Walker about that. Sometimes you're accused of having a bad attitude. Mr. Walker looked and smiled. He goes, that's because they didn't know the answer. So you had a bad attitude because they didn't know the answer. Then you saw some of these things transpire. Again, nobody was perfect throughout that. But all of a sudden, some changes. We had troubles. For those of you who are on the 74 or 75, maybe I'm off the mark a little bit there. We had something come across that was, as some would remember it as STP. It's called the Standard Theology Project. And there were things, I didn't read all that was in there. All I know was it caused problems, caused divisions. A lot of people left the church. There was a big brouhaha in Washington, D.C. And guess who was sent in there to try to help and fix it? Mr. Larry Salyer. That was another one of his transfers. So going through all that hoopla and all the infighting that was in the Church of God, how could that happen? Because I came with a church that was supposed to be perfect. They were supposed to have it on the ball. They had it right. They had the truth. They were the church. Then you read history and you go all the way back to Moses. It never worked that way, did it? And all of a sudden, then in the 80s, which was a great time, well, because remember in 78, there was the government that got involved in the church out in Pasadena. And Mr. Armstrong had to set up the corporation Saul. And there was this whole government, overtaking the church at the time. And then that qualm went away after a while. And then Mr. Armstrong would say, the church is now back on track. And wow, it was great. We were in Big Sandy at a great time, in the college at a great time. It seemed like the truth was being professed and you were being overlorded and overbearing. It seemed to be service and not everyone got that, but a lot of people did. We did. It was a great time. Didn't last very long. 1986, Herbert Armstrong dies. And not many people knew, but, they'd say, well, later on in the 90s, they were changing in 87. I still have a pastor general's report where Satan hit really hard. That Christ's sacrifice is not so meaningful as we think it is. In fact, we saw kind of the same resurgence in the recent papers on healing or fasting, and it didn't look so good. No, he's not so concerned about your physical. I've got the PGR. the changes were starting to come. So what did Satan go after? Faith. And I wasn't in the ministry, but I saw people's response to it. I saw what was taking place. People would go, I was invited to come into a laying on of hands for healing, just to be another one to be in there. And the elder was, I think, inspired by asking, how long have you had this? He goes, well, you know, I had it before I was healed, and now it's come back again. So he asked, well, you know, have you prayed about it? And the guy goes, I've not prayed in months. Wow. You know, where there are some people would say, I don't even know who God is anymore. When some more of those changes started coming in, how long did that last? You know, the truth in God's church and the peace has never been for extended times at all. It's always been disrupted, and you could see it going all the way back. Well, John was evident; he understood that, and obviously God inspired this man to write some interesting letters. So if we go to the first chapter of John, we're going to find this same event covered that was written in Mark chapter 3 that we just covered. In Mark chapter 3, we find out in John 1 verse 40, you can see the same thing, but there's something different here. And I remember that going back to the original correspondence courses, if some of you remember those. Well, I remember most of us, if you came into church at that time, you really ate those correspondences, those courses up, because it was so new. The understanding that was given at the time, we go, wow. And some of these I remember specifically too. John 1 verse 40, one of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He found his own brother Simon and said to him, we found the Messiah, which is being interpreted, the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus, and when Jesus held him, he said, you are Simon, the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. So now he says this in this chapter, but he uses the word Cephas, not Peter. In Luke 3, you found the name given by Jesus was Peter, but in John we find the name Cephas. So which one was it? Cephas or Peter, that was the additional name. Now here's the answer. The language that was spoken by Jesus was Aramaic. And the name given to Simon by Jesus was an Aramaic name. It was Cephas. Peter is a Greek name. Now in Greek, it's the rough equivalent of Cephas, and the Gospels, with the possible exception of Matthew, were all written in Greek. Therefore, everything, often including the names, was translated into the English language. Now, for those that are monolingual, I don't know how many know two or more languages that are here, even though I took 4 years of French, I wouldn't consider that. I'm monolingual. I can say a couple of things, but not much, because I never used it. So you would think that if your name was Sharon, then you go to Russia and your name would be Sharon. Or if you're Larry in China, it'd be Larry. Well, when I got there, they changed my name. They didn't call me Eric. They gave us all names. And I didn't understand it totally. Maybe I didn't understand the roots, but I still remember my name. They called me Owe-er. Owe. So a lot of the guys and my classmates would say, away, away, and now I'm in the South. So anyway, away-er. And if you looked at the literal translation, it meant strong, powerful European. Strong, powerful European. That's really interesting. Now, did that make me feel a lot stronger? No, maybe quite. What's going on here? Because I'm American. Number one, maybe the roots go back to Europe, but what's the significance here? And then the other one, another one, he was a tall redhead. I can't remember what the name was. I can only remember the translation because he was a tall redhead and the interpretation was Army of Hot Plums. Where does that one come from? So you read about, for instance, a man named, for the history buffs here, Charles the Great in European history. Now, in Germany, he's not Charles the Great. For those of you not know German, what would that be? It's Karl de Grossa. It means the same thing. And in Spain, he's known as Carlos de Grande. It doesn't have in their history books Charles the Great, Carlos de Grande. So what would he be in France? What would he be in France? You've heard of this. You've heard of this leader, great leader, Charlemagne. If you know the roots, I knew that M-A-G-N-E was great in French. So you get Charlemagne from Charles the Great. You would think they're two different people. Same people. So in America, what would they call him in America? I remember some time ago I saw a pizza restaurant for kids. What was it called? Chuck E. Cheese. So with a big cheese, maybe. So just throwing in a joke there. He's not the big cheese. He would be, you know, but it's hard to put in America Charles the Great. That would be in our history books, or Charlemagne, as a better known of. So you read Charles the Great in one book, Charlemagne in another, and you can even read some of the dates, same events, same connection with the Pope, and you don't comprehend that it's the same guy. Because we're only familiar sometimes with one language, aren't we? So John wrote of the event. He translated the words of Jesus into Greek except for this name. He felt compelled to use the Aramaic. So why did he feel compelled to make that point? He did not give the name Peter. He gave it to Cephas. So here is where we come to. This is so incredibly, the information here. I'll tell you of a situation I went through that helped me to really understand how so many look at this. What was the confusion? Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. Here it is. Matthew 16, verse 18. And I had a talk with someone that really helped me to figure out the mentality without being, in a sense, judgmental, but understanding that there's a reason that people have, even if it's misdirected, of why they believe what they believe. And that comes from here, Matthew 16, verse 18. And I say to you also that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Notice the name Peter. Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So we can see that the church will never fail. We understand that. Now some say, though, that Peter means rock. Is that so? Do you remember those first correspondence courses? I remember that. This was well pointed out. Fascinating. If you didn't look at words anymore, this was one to look up. Let's look it up. You are Peter. Greek word, Petros. What's the definition? Stone. Stone. And on this rock, what word? We talked about this for years. This is another one that we had to get through. Because you were trying to make your reservations for this big rock in Jordan called Petra. Remember all the times we talk about Petra? 3.5 years, Petra. How are you going to do that? Where's the rooms? They got to build a Holiday Inn or something there for people to go, and otherwise it's going to be hard to sleep in rocks. On this rock, Petra, that entire mountain range is named, as we would call it, Petra, the rock. And when you search the scriptures over, Jesus Christ is referred to as the rock. Do the search on that one. How many times is he pointed out as the rock? In fact, if you want a copy of that, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 4, don't go, I'll just read this to you. And they all drank of that same spiritual drink, and they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and it specifies that rock was Christ. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4, he is the rock. His work is perfect. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 2, there's none holy as the Lord, there's none beside you, neither is there any rock. Who is a rock besides the Lord? We sing that one. That's the rock. Peter was never called the rock. So there's a similar parallel even in Aramaic. In Aramaic, as we learn from the book of John, Cephas means stone, not rock. The other Aramaic word, Sela, C-E-L-A, that means rock. So here's what you've got. Petro, stone, Petra, rock. Cephas, stone, Sela, rock. So John was pointing out something to make it clear that there was any man that was going to be a rock. But yet the battle on that to try to point that out, no, Jesus Christ is the rock. He's the head of the church. He's the chief apostle. He's the high priest. You have similar construction in two different languages. John said that Jesus did not give Simon the name Peter. He gave him the Aramaic name Cephas. And you'll never find anywhere a priest called a Cephas. So let's finish the verse in Matthew 16, and I'll give you, or here it says, that's why I brought my old King James. You're going to have this translated probably in yours just a you. But I need to specify that because there are some differences here. It says, I will give to thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever thou will be loosed on earth will be loosed in heaven. So you have a powerful verse here, in which today's Catholics use for the base of having biblical authority of having a pope to rule the church. That's what that's all about. And at least it was fair. When I asked the person about this, they go, well, we're given the keys, and our leader today is given the keys to bind on earth and to bind in heaven, even to the point we're changing the laws, to changing the Sabbath to another day. At least that was honest conversation, though. No attempt to cover up just what they believe looking in there, but is that what that really says? If you'll notice also in verse 19, it uses the English equivalent of thee and thou. And you don't ever call attention much to that anymore because it's not translated that way unless you're using the old Bible. Because we transfer these into modern English. But thee and thou are singular. That is the singular way of saying you, and in this verse it limits it to Peter. He says, I'll give to you, Peter, the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on, will you, Peter, bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you, Peter, will loose on earth will be loosed in heaven, thereby seemingly giving Peter the absolute authority. But the same passing of authority can be found in Matthew 18. Let's look at that, Matthew chapter 18 and verse 18. The same passing that can be found right here. Verily I say unto you, whatever ye shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever ye shall loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. You find, in verse 18, you find you and ye, not thou and thee. You know what that means? You and ye in English is plural. It cannot refer to one person. So who is it referring to? Well, if you look at Matthew 18, let's go back to the context. Context, verse 1. Many times you can go back to the beginning and find the context. At the same time came the disciples to Jesus asking, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Now they're asking him a question about government. And frankly, they were kind of mixed up. Because it always came down to who was going to be the greatest, who was going to be the... So this is a big thing to God and Jesus Christ when it talks about that. And after prefacing the attitude that one should possess, he answered how it would be. In verse 19, he said, again, I say to you that if two of you will agree on earth as touching anything that they will ask, it will be done for them of my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them. Verse 20 today is misconstrued. And people use this all the time to say, well, me and my family are going to stay home from church today, or we're going to go with a couple other people and just listen to a telecast or a broadcast. And that's the holy convocation, because if here it says we're two or three, the problem is this is not talking about a holy convocation. This is talking about rendering judgments within the church. And now Jesus was saying, I did say it to Peter, but it's not just for him. It's for all of you to get together collectively. And where do you see examples of that? Acts chapter 3. And it wasn't easy because they had to come together to discuss this. And not any of one came up with absolute authority and made their final decision because the others, what's going on here? We're all in this collectively. We're in this together. And God inspired them, thankfully, for the most part, to agree on it, though not all of them did. So he said in verse 21, Peter came to him and asked, Lord, how often shall I brother sin against me and I forgive him? Until seven times? Jesus said, I say not to you until seven times, but 70 times seven. See, he's talking about the mercy incorporation here. It's a total different outlook from how man looks at it. How many times do I have to forgive this guy? And Christ could have said, Peter, how many times I had to forgive you? Seven times? Very interesting, isn't it? But we find the power of binding and loosing, giving collectively to the disciples. In this further clarification, God says in essence that it's going to take two or three of you. I know in modern day times there's had to be binding and loosing when it comes to marriages. Some marriages, can I unbind that? You have to go by the detail that God gives to us in the scripture. You can't just say, well, you don't like each other, so therefore I'm going to unbind this marriage or I'm going to bind this marriage. You got to take a collective look at it and ask God for his inspiration. You've got to have multitude of counsel when you do this. And we go through extensive types of things before a marriage would be unbound. And it's got to be from a scriptural direction. And is it easy? Not one iota. It's so difficult sometimes when you have to do something like that. It's not a fun thing to do. It's not an authoritative thing to do. You're doing something that was bound in heaven. And you're going to try to unbind that on your own or by yourself? You better be collective with that. One can't just assume that. And it's got to be through the scriptures. It can't change the law of God. In John chapter 20, verse 21. John chapter 20, verse 21. Something happens with the ye here as well. John 20, verse 21. Same thing here. Then Jesus said to them again, peace be unto you, as my Father has sent me, even so I send to you. When he said this, he breathed on them and said to them, receive ye the Holy Spirit. Whoever sins ye remit, they are remitted to them, and whoever sins ye retain, they are retained. So you don't have that. So that question is not going to come up in the New King James Version today. But it's important to understand what God is doing and how he is working, and this is the way that it's rendered. You see the singular and plural of the Old English again, the use of the yous and yees. So it was a serious responsibility clarified and placed in the hands of apostles, and some would like to place that absolute authority in the place of Peter, leaving the others simply in an advisory capacity. And I've seen that in a sense as well, even in modern day testimonies within the church, but that's not what the scriptures reveal at all. So but others point out again, well, Peter's a lot of times listed first, and he's not always listed first. The order of Peter's listing among the apostles, he's usually listed first, sometimes in question of structure, some bring that up, but he's not always listed first. In Galatians 2 verse 9, James is listed first. So is there some place where it says that Peter is the first? Let's go to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 verse 2. And is this that important when you look at that? The names of it says in chapter 2, verse 2 of Matthew 10, the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who's called Peter, Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. So Matthew listed it this way. Now obviously we can see other scriptures too that point out what was used on the sign over the stake where Christ hung. One would say this, another would say that, another would say that. You're always going to see differences in the way that some of the writers perceive that. That doesn't mean at all that one was first or one became the chief. So you better look up the word first. The Greek word is called protos. Now, when you look at the definition in the lexicon, Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich, it gives a variety of definition. Now, the first, and sometimes in Greek or when you're looking up in Strong's or others, a lot of times the first one is a primary one that's used, but not always. You have to many times look at the structure, at the context. Now, protos in this lexicon says it's the earliest. So if you define it that way, then Peter was the earliest apostle. But if you read the Gospels, the first apostles that were chosen seem to be Andrew and Matthew, was also called Levi. And while there's speculation about this, doesn't seem to be any who would believe that this was giving Peter the first and the preeminent leader. That's a possible definition. So if you eliminate the most common definitions, you're left with two others, that he's a preeminent leader. Did he take the lead? Peter did do that, didn't he? But, you know, in being a preeminent leader, the one that stood out, the one that was a spokesman, the one that always kind of put his foot in his mouth as well, that's what happens. How do I understand that? Extrovert. See, the easiest part of introverts is they don't talk a whole lot. Probably problem with extroverts, we talk too much. And that gives us a lot more opportunity to put our foot in our mouth in which you can see what the example of Peter did so, didn't he? But it didn't really stop him because that was his nature, that was kind of his character. And he spoke out. He, in a sense, was a preeminent leader, but it doesn't mean that he was the first. Acts 15, verse 22. We're almost done here. Acts 15, verse 22. So we see now these preeminents, ones that want to make someone the chief, the overall, and you can see again, looking throughout the scripture, takes all those titles. Acts 15, verse 22, it pleased the apostles and elders and the whole church. Here's an example right here. It pleased the apostles, elders, with the whole church. So they were all in agreement on this. So it was almost like you go back to Joshua. He wasn't the preeminent. He had to go through Eliezer, and they were both in agreement on what was given to Israel. And then that had to be given, by the way, to all the chiefs of all the different tribes. How was that information going to get out with no phones? You know, that information had to be spread out and given by other leaders as well. Now, here you have a congregation, because it says to send chosen men of their own company to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, namely Judas, surnamed Barsabbas, and Silas, chief men among the congregation. They definitely took leadership roles, didn't they? And the congregation knew it. So the congregation knew it. The leaders did it. And they were all in agreement about doing this, sending representatives to accompany a donation or a gift. But it says these are chief men. So can we take it to mean that Judas was the top dog with absolute authority over the church? It actually names two of them who are chief, but you can't have two chiefs. I know there's an adage about that. There can only be one in the kitchen. I don't know how many have tried two in the kitchen. It doesn't work too well, as far as I've been told anyway. But, you know, if you're talking about the role of a chief, shouldn't it be Peter, who many thought that would be the chief? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. Let's go after the chief here. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2. Two scriptures left after 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. 1 Peter 5, verse 2, here's the instruction. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for money, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd will appear, you'll receive a crown of glory that does not fade away. Why is this so important? Because this is the whole point about the kingdom of God coming. There's going to be government. There's going to be authority. There's going to be rulership. There's going to be positions, but we're going to get this. God's saints, his chosen first fruits, are going to understand this concept, because you can't get into the kingdom without that knowledge. That type of service, which is so important to God and Jesus Christ, going from the beginning of the Bible to the very end. So here the word for shepherd is correctly translated from the Greek word poimen. In other words, in places it's translated as a pastor. One word, one of the titles that's used to describe the ministry. So Peter says that the chief minister is Christ. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, here is Paul's defense of this. Interesting how he pointed this out. Paul knew who he was. He knew that he definitely was called by God in a very humble way, because he was so very zealous that God had to take him through a lot of trials. And, you know, he's the one that asked for prayer for healing. God said, hey, no, your infirmity glorifies me. You better understand that, with having that much authority for what he was doing, what he was called to do, is a smart man as well. And he says here, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 11, I have become a fool in glorying. You have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended of you. For in nothing I am behind the very chiefest apostles, though I am nothing. So Paul says there's no one ahead of me in a sense of anything. So you could have to take that to mean writing. No one really wrote more than Paul, did they? When you look at all the writings of Paul, in preaching, he was probably a very effective preacher. And would have to, you'd have to say even in authority. Other words, he would say, in nothing except in authority am I behind the very chief apostle. The problem with that is they all had different assignments by God to go different places and do different things. You didn't find Paul trailing behind Peter and telling him what to do. They all had assignments by Jesus Christ on what they were supposed to do, and they all died in pretty horrendous ways in that sense of martyrdom. But he didn't even use the term, except I'm behind the very chief apostle. He said the very chiefest apostles. How many chief apostles can there be? If he's saying the chiefest apostles. So this alone says there were not someone with absolute authority. There just cannot be several chief apostles. Let's go finally here to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23 and verse 8. Here's Christ's admonishment here. And thankfully, once again, if you've not been in the church very long and you look at the church history, God is certain Jesus Christ as the head of the church has taken us in directions to understand this more, to have that vision of what the scripture is saying impressed within us. I'm not saying that people here don't understand that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. I think we understand the concept a lot better now, though. I remember hearing from our headquarters church about a building that we had. Remember, we had some really nice buildings. We had some beautiful buildings. The Ambassador Auditorium, dedicated to the honor and glory of the great God. It became nothing. We lost it. So what was important to God? The physical? Do we get that more? From what I've heard, I think we do. Unless the Lord builds the house. We've got a nice building. But if that's not dedicated to the honor, if we're not functioning, it's just a building. It's what we do out of there that's most important in recognizing who is the one, who is the true builder, who is the true chief. Verse 8 of Matthew 23, but be you not called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all you are brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father who is in heaven. I think you got the concept there. I can call my dad or father. It's understanding of the relationship between the father. There's no one greater, no physical dad today, nothing like that. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father who is in heaven. Neither be called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. And here's the point. He that's greatest among you will be your servant. So if he is talking about somebody, a great one is supposed to be one that serves, that leads in a giving and understanding way, that's got a high ethics and principles, that follows himself on the principles of God's law. And whoever will exalt himself will be abased, and he will humble himself will be exalted, because that's the way that God works. And he may not see it now. There's lots of leaders out there that are exalted, right? Lots of leaders that we've seen in church history. They've been up there. You've seen the Hitlers. You've seen the Maos. You've seen all those, the Lenins and the leaders of before and the ones of today. It says, you know, you humble yourself. You're eventually going to go down. But this is the way that God works. So if one needs to, concluding here, If you want to understand about government, and again, there's very few references just to the word government, but to really understand this, it's this verse in Matthew 23, and it does in other places that you can go to find the essential principles of government that are given for the New Testament church. One is your master or chief, or as you could have easily been rendered, they essentially mean the same thing. One is your master, one is your chief, one is the head of the church, one is the rock, and that's Christ. Thanks be to God the Father that he gave us a chief that understands government, who set for us the example of servant leadership, because there can be no other chief, and there is no other chief who can take this role and responsibility. And if we see this and understand it in our lives and recognize that we're going to have positions of authority and responsibility, but that is to serve. And if we understand that and accept that, then we are truly founded on the rock.